Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. As Jacqueline alluded to, the hall is beginning to fill up again. For those of you who are new to the community, pre-COVID, we used to have 70, 80, 90 in the hall and 20 or 30 online. Then during COVID, we had everybody online. And maybe I was in the hall with the person on the camera and maybe someone on the bell. And then slowly we have been beginning to follow a general reopening of our society as more and more of us have been vaccinated. So today we have 40 plus in the hall, and how many do we have online? 88. So it's beginning to change again. Balance out, that's good. So I want to talk today about something that's, I think, very meaningful in our society as individuals, but I think it's also societal. An issue that's very, you know, it's a problematic issue for many people in many different areas. It's called boundaries. Anybody ever hear about boundaries and boundary issues? I mean, anybody else? So, and the reason I said it, because I had a discussion about a month or so ago with one of our members who was talking about some issue that was going on in their personal life. And I just kind of said, you know, I think the only issue here is that this is a boundary issue. And they looked at me and said, hold on. I thought, you know, the Buddhist practice is all about no boundaries. You know, complete openness. So anyhow, that got me thinking that it's kind of tricky, isn't it? So I want to talk today about boundaries. And again, I went online yesterday to look up boundaries, personal boundaries, and it goes on for thousands of pages, right? And all kinds of people have websites and blogs just dealing with boundaries, all kinds of books. So I won't go into kind of the more interpersonal boundary issues, you know, the codependency movement, recovery movement, lots of good stuff out there about boundaries. But I want to talk to it, I'll talk about it, some of it, but I really want to talk to it, address it in terms of Buddhism. So on the one hand, we have Buddhism. And Buddhism is based on non-self. It's one of the great insights of the Buddha. That the self that appears as a solid, real thing doesn't really exist in that way. It's a misperception. And so because of that, Buddhism talks about oneness, non-separation, interbeing, right? Interconnection, right? Fundamental ethical teaching of Buddhism is ahimsa, right? Nonviolence, do no harm, right? Like turn the other cheek. Kind of a boundless compassion. You know, we understand everybody. We understand, you know, we have compassion both for the victims, but we have compassion for the perpetrators because we understand these are moving experiences. We understand everyone suffers. Aren't we supposed to think of others ahead of ourself? Aren't we here to make others happy, right? Aren't we here to bring happiness to them and help fulfill their needs? There even in the mind trainings, it says, you know, take defeat upon oneself, give victory to others, right? So I could go on and on, but it's a, so the Buddhist teachings, from one point of view, is really all about unconditional acceptance, everything open, total compassion, love for the world, understanding for everybody, right? Sort of a boundaryless kind of non-separation, right? So we might say, on one hand, in the purest sense, these are the Buddhist teachings that we hear, and of course, very meaningful. And in the Buddhist literature, you know, and some of these I've shared, you know, there are these stories of like the stories I think I shared recently, maybe it was in the Chan intensive, you know, that great story of Hakuin. I won't go into it, but he's, you know, Hakuin is a famous Japanese Zen master, sort of before his pre-fame days when he was just a village priest. There was a young woman in the village who became pregnant from one of the village boys. When she sort of couldn't hide it anymore, her parents, of course, were outraged and demanded that she tell them who the father was. And she knew if she told them about her secret boyfriend, you know, he would be he'd be killed or something, you know, severely. So she picked a safe target. She said, Hakuin, the village priest. He's the father, right? And so, you know, parents, you know, he's a monk, right? So the parents bring the newborn baby to Hakuin. You know, tell him, you know, we found out what you did. I can't believe you did this. It's your baby. You take care of it. And Hakuin just bowed. And then for about a year, Hakuin takes care of the infant. No opposition, just takes care of the infant. And during, of course, that year, you know, the young woman is feeling more and more regret, you know, and misses the child and just realizes, you know, she's done a great injustice, because of course this has besmirched Hakuin's. So after about a year, she finally told her parents who the real father was, and Hakuin wasn't. And then, you know, the parents came, and the daughter came to the temple, asked for the baby back, begged forgiveness. They were so ashamed, they can't believe. And you know what Hakuin did? He bowed. So there we have quite, you know, so that's in the literature, right? Quite an example of no boundaries, right? There's a great saying which is, you know, when others are wrong, I am wrong too. This is these kind of wonderful teachings which kind of break down all barriers and kind of make the individual totally connected with everyone else. You know, no defensiveness, right? No barriers. I mean, I could go on, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, here's a quote. In a deep relationship, there is no longer a boundary between you and the other person. You are her, she is you. Your suffering is her suffering. Your understanding of your own suffering helps your loved one to suffer less. Right, again, this great interconnection. And sort of co-responsibility. I am responsible for you, right? I take responsibility for you, right? So this is the kind of teachings, right, that we are all exposed to when we study Buddhism. On the other hand, there is our modern society, right? And what do we know about our modern society in its more therapeutic manifestation in both the therapeutic movement? I was a therapist, you know, and family therapy and dynamics, in the whole codependency and addiction movement. I mean, it's all about what? Healthy boundaries, right? Actually, we have a, what's it called? We have a whole manual. It's called what? What? Sangha Harmony Guide, which is really all about healthy boundaries, right? And so from this point of view, boundaries are needed. Boundaries are healthy. There needs to be a clear line between me and you, right? Both a physical boundary, which is sort of easier to see, but the more subtle and more difficult, of course, is emotional boundaries. Hey, what about my needs, right? Boundary. Right? I want somebody to take care of my needs. I'm here to take care of my needs. Self-care, my space, my private time, my life, right? So sort of on the other hand is this very conditional. The other is very unconditional. The side is very conditional, right? It's this kind of side is sort of non-self, interdependence, interconnection. The side is very much self, self-care, right? So can you see the confusion, right? You know, and again, so what I want to talk about today, and then I hope to open it up and have time, is I want to, I think it's a very meaningful discussion, since I think it's, again, definitely by the little bit of 30 minutes of just, you know, doing what's called a Google search. It was obviously relationships and boundary, you know, very, very prominent in the virtual world. So, where is it dividing line? I think that's to say. So, physical boundaries, again, are more obvious, right? So, the most obvious physical boundary is what? My body and your body, right? And to clearly delineate, you know, we have separate bodies, and that I'm responsible for my body, you're responsible of your body. I mean, if you think of, you know, the things that have been going on in our society, you know, the whole issue of not only sexual abuse, but the whole issue, you know, the Me Too movement. I mean, that's all about what? Boundaries, right? You know, oftentimes, you know, I mean, it's often again just a lack of clarity about boundaries, right? And so therefore, in that lack of clarity, it is very easy for people to overstep, to take advantage of, to use power relationships and all that thing. But it's all about boundaries. So again, I think the physical boundary is simpler. Again, and I think the operating principle within Buddhism is always do no harm. Do no harm. And so if that is both on both sides, you know, do no harm is the key operant mind state. I think oftentimes those physical boundaries, at least in terms of the body, can be seen, but of course we know that's not often the case. People are very much, you know, it's sort of like imperialism and colonialism, right? You know, there are certain people who believe they have a right to claim other people's bodies as theirs. And unfortunately, there are other people who still believe, you know, that they are obligated, right? To surrender their bodies to those who are wanting to take it, right? And again, we'll talk about the emotional issue. So again, in a certain way, I think physical boundaries are much more obvious. You know, the first precept of Buddhism ethics is do no harm, do not hurt, and in all relationships. The whether it's physical relationships, sexual relationships, drugs, alcohol, you know, use of speech. I mean, all of the aspects of Buddhist ethics in terms of body, speech, and mind. There's a clear boundary between what is harmful and what is helpful, right? What is nurturing and what is destructive. Of course, you know, I'm going to come to how meditation, mindfulness. plays into this. It is the, so let's say, and again, this really comes a lot from the, you know, from the therapeutic world, you know, there's sort of like, so there's certain boundaries like we're talking about, which we might say trespassing, right? So like, you know, if somebody's on your property or somebody's in your home and they don't belong there, we would say what? They're trespassing, right? I mean, you know, when we go from one country to another, there's a clear boundary. You cannot cross that boundary without some conscious identification, you know, that you have a right to cross that boundary, and there's often somebody there to what? To check your bona fides, that you have that right. So physical boundaries and the violation by trespassing, again, is something I think it's probably where we begin for many people. I think if people do not, if people, because of their conditioning, their upbringing, other kinds of things, do not know about even physical boundaries, because they were not taught it or they were violated early on, it's very hard to talk about the emotional, right? Emotional boundaries, if someone doesn't have a sense of physical boundaries. And again, because that's more obvious, I think that's a good place to talk. And again, to start, and again, I think it's totally, you know, I mean, it's, as I said, in terms of Buddhist teaching, it is totally congruent to that. Now, again, do you hear, are there, you know, are there teachings where, we have these wonderful teachings, you know, in the previous life of the Buddha, where he's, it's always about sacrifice, you know, he sacrifices his body, they sacrifice their arm, they sacrifice an eye, they do all these, my body is just here to serve you, right? But that is the activity of a highly awakened person, right? Who is making a choice, a decision consciously, right? So please understand that. You know, I've often told the story on my first, back in 1975, some of you probably were not even born then. My first trip to India, went there to study Buddhism, got into Delhi late at night. That's when the flights used to arrive at 2-3 in the morning. Went to this, it was a guest house for people from Ladakh, which was a Buddhist part of India, Ladakhis. And so got there, all turned around, and in the morning, as people began to wake up, because we were on the kind of the opposite time frame, some younger guy spoke English. So he began talking to us, and when he found out we were here for Buddhism, he said, oh, there's a great teacher here. You have to come meet him. So he arranged for us to go meet him. And we had a wonderful interchange with this really wonderful teacher, with the young man translating. So at some point he says, he's talking about the Buddha, and he's referring to all these past life stories of the Buddha of, this incredible sacrifice. As I just referred to. And he says, he looks at me and goes, you have to understand, these stories are true. People actually can do those things. Then he looked at me and says, but you can't. You're not there yet. So don't you be go doing that stuff. So, again, that's, so we have to understand when we read these teachings, there's a developmental path here. Buddhism is a developmental path. And a teaching that's given to one person is not given to another person, right? So over here, the teaching may be to, well, anyhow, I think you understand. So, I mean, we can't be confused. We have to always check in with ourselves. So the trespassing is, I think, clearer, right? The emotional, which in therapeutic language is called enmeshment, is less obvious, right? And so that's, and I think, obviously we have a problem in the society, with this trespassing and physical boundaries and respecting them. But again, I think we even have a greater problem, it seems, just on an ongoing basis in all relationships with this idea of enmeshment, where one really cannot distinguish between who I am and who you are, and my needs and your needs, and, you know, an ability to see that there is a place of distinguishment that is healthy, right? And there's a place when it's not healthy. You know, I think many people, when they learn about emotional boundaries and enmeshment means you can't see, you can't distinguish. Things are enmeshed. You know, often our relationships are enmeshed. We can't distinguish my needs from their needs. We can't distinguish a request from a demand. You know, and again, I can talk about that more because it's unclear, you know, whose problem is this? We're enmeshed. Can I see that it's your problem and not my problem? But I'm making your problem my problem. We're enmeshed, right? I feel responsible for solving your problems. I feel responsible for your life. You know, I'm completely unable to really manage my life, but yet I am totally responsible for your life, right? Enmeshment. We can't distinguish with clarity who I am. Now I'm talking, now you might go, hold on, I thought Buddhism talks about no self. What's going on here? Well, Buddhism does not talk about no self. It's got to be defined. Buddhism says this separate independent self that we identify with is not truly the way things are. That it's really, it cannot be found in any permanent solid way. And yet, this is called Fred, right? And Fred has a stewardship, a responsibility to taking care of this, which is a body-mind, right? So I have a stewardship for this that I have to be responsible for. So I can be a good steward of this without strongly identifying this as a solid, permanent thing, self. So this is another whole Dharma teaching on self and not self. So in a functional way, it is useful to have a healthy identity, right? The truth is, one cannot really practice Buddhism and meditation successfully if one does not have a healthy sense of self. One has a certain degree of confidence. One has a certain degree of efficacy in one's life. One is grounded. One has a certain degree of clarity and self-awareness. You know, one needs those kind of self-skills, right, to be able to navigate the spiritual path, the ups and downs of meditation, right? So again, in a certain way, having a healthy, a robust sense of oneself without kind of having it be rigid and defensive and purely reactive is good, okay? So obviously when two healthy cells, so to speak, engage with each other, there can be a lot of openness. There can be a lot of interconnection. But without self-awareness, that when one crosses over and is taking responsibility for basically something that one is not, it's not only that one is not responsible for, but one is not able to really affect any real meaningful change in that person, right? Why? Because nobody likes to be controlled. Does anybody notice that? I mean, we like to control other people. We like to tell other people what to do, and we like to make sure they're meeting our needs and doing exactly what we want and responding to us the way we want. I mean, you know, you see what I'm saying? I mean, from that point of view, I mean, we're definitely into control, manipulation. But when it's turned on us, and somebody's now controlling us, I mean, we perceive, it may, in lots of cases it may not be accurate, but we perceive that, we don't, that's not comfortable for us, is it? So how do we navigate this world, holding on to these wonderful Buddhist teachings, right? Of non-self, of openness, of interconnection, of understanding, of acceptance, of, you know, as I think it was Camus who wrote, you know, no victims, no executioners. You know, how do you kind of have that high vision of life, and yet on a very practical, interactive way, you know, maintain, again, a sense of self-awareness. You're in touch with yourself. You're in touch with your feelings. See, this is what meditation's about. Meditation is not some escape. Many people think of meditation as an escape from reality. No, meditation is an ability to enter reality with awareness, with presence, with understanding. Right? So through the process of mindful meditation, one develops a relationship to oneself. One knows who one is. We know what we're feeling. We know what's comfortable, what's uncomfortable. We know our values. It's another important part of a kind of a mature human being, is we have values, right? And they're not just up here, but we kind of live them. So when someone's trying to violate something I value, or when someone is trying to get me to violate a value, I'm aware of what's going on. You see, I'm self-aware. And I'm not afraid. Right? And I think fear and anger, fear especially for so many people, short circuits that ability to not only be present to themselves, self-aware, but also to be able to enter the world of relationship. I mean, all kinds of relationships, personal, interpersonal, work, societal, right? And be able to assert clearly to other human beings, this is who I am, and this doesn't work. It often appears as saying no. Now again, people may say, hold on, Fred, I've heard you give teachings where the practice of Buddhism is always to say yes. Yes, say yes to life. Somebody asks you to do something, you say yes. That is true. That's one way to really dismantle the self, but don't give up your values. Don't give up your self-awareness of what's comfortable. Now again, sometimes we need to push against our own boundaries, because they may not be healthy boundaries. They may be rigid. They may be inflexible. We have created boundaries for ourselves that are fundamentally come from an unhealthy place in ourselves, an unhealthy childhood. We might have learned to put up all kinds of boundaries and walls, you know, that's a boundary, but it's not healthy for us. It inhibits us. It walls us off for other people. It prevents us from entering life in a full and open way. Not controlling. I want to leave time for discussion, but I think that'll be richer. But I want to read you a story. It comes from the Indian tradition. It's a story of the snake and the sage. So I'll just read it. One day, a wise old sage was passing through a village, and the village children crowded around him because they were terrified of a cobra that lived in a field where they played. So the sage sought out the serpent, admonished him not to bite the children, and gave him some spiritual teachings, gave him a mantra to recite. And the cobra said, yes, I will follow you. And he went on his way. Turned out that cobra was a very unusual cobra, became a very devoted practitioner. And all of a sudden, the children in the village began to notice the old cobra was not threatening them anymore, was not biting anybody. Mm-hmm. So, but they, you know, they still remembered all the mean things he did, and they were still afraid of him. So taking advantage of his new peaceful state, whenever they would see him, they would pick him up by the tail, whirl him about, hit him hard, and throw him down on the ground and beat him. Years later, the sage comes back through the village. And he asks around, you know, has anybody seen my devotee, the snake? Well, the truth is, no one had seen the snake for a while. People thought he was dead. So the sage went in search of him. And when he finally found him under some bush or something, the creature was barely alive, bruised and broken. The teacher was saddened by his state. What happened? He said. Teacher, I did as you told me, and I stopped biting everybody in the village. But when they saw I would no longer bite them, they swung me around, threw me to the ground, and just beat me all the time. Fool, said the teacher. I told you not to bite, but I never told you not to hiss. Is that clear? Sometimes, you know, teaching stories tells more than all the words we speak. You know, hissing is nonviolent, right? Hissing is nonviolent. It is not doing harm. But it's also letting someone know that, that if you continue to approach, you know, there's somebody here to deal with. Right? I mean, there are many ways to interpret what our hissing could look like as human beings. But I think that's one key way. So I would like to open this up. Again, I mean, there's more I could say, but I would rather say it in interaction. So again, since I know this is an issue that everybody has, so in the hall, we have a mic, so just put your hands up like this, and on the chat it in, and you will just let me know that someone on has chatted in a question for anybody who's online. And for those of you online, there is a chat function underneath your screen. So, questions? And again, for those of you new, don't be shy. We all have issues around, you know. So anything just about generally about this whole issue of boundaries, but also any specific kinds of situations, you go, how would it apply here? So let's just open it up. Nothing's off topic. Yes. Just wait. No, because we have a lot of people online, so that's what the mic is for. That's okay.
When you were talking about enmeshment, if I'm saying that word correctly, it sounded a lot like codependency. Mm-hmm. So what I interpreted that as, if you can't truly take care of somebody else unless you've taken care of yourself, mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
That's somewhat accurate. I mean, I think generally, the more healthier we are, right? The more we have done our own work, the better able we are able to be there for others and help others, okay? But I'm always concerned when we turn these into rigid laws, because, you know, our journey to to healing and transformation is not going to unfold in the next few weeks. Right, and so along the way, we may be able to help people, right? And so, but helping, wanting to help people, but being very clear of boundary issues will make it a lot easier and less painful for you and the other person. But again, you know, I also want to say, you know, especially with enmeshment, right, emotional codependency, it's often not clear, is it? You know, it's not like physical boundaries. It's not clear. So sometimes you may think you're doing something that is helpful, but as you watch what happens, you realize, I'm just perpetuating, right? And so, again, I think it's a process, right? you know, where you kind of, if you're ready to act, you act, but you're also very careful and mindful of kind of how it plays out. And if it doesn't play out the way you, you know, for example, a friend, you know, is in trouble or going through a difficult time and they ask your advice, right? Okay. You see him a week later, friend's in trouble, they ask your advice. See him a week later, a month later, same trouble, they ask your advice, they cry on your shoulder, right? At a certain point, what do you realize?
Maybe you're not very helpful.
Or it could
maybe
be.
Maybe your advice isn't helpful.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. The other way could be they're not really interested in changing. I think that's often, yeah, I mean, you see what I'm saying? Yeah, I think often the bigger issues, they're not ready to change, right? And so I'm just, you know, one, I'm wasting my time. There may be something better to do. But two, I'm not helping them. You see, because there's some kind of self-awareness, you see. Because if you're going to help somebody reduce their suffering, you want to help them, right? And so it's often, again, our enmeshment in these relationships, our fear, as I mentioned that earlier, you know, our fear, that's one thing, we're so afraid. You know, we're going to hurt somebody's feelings. Whatever that means, right? We're afraid that how they're going to perceive us or reject. You know, it's like these are not healthy reasons, right? Or anger. You know, sometimes we help out of anger. You know, so we say and do things that really aren't that helpful. So the less emotionality there is within us, the more clarity, i.e., we've done our own work. Then we're free to help. And we're free not to help. Right? Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Other questions? Yes. Yeah, I mean, we were just kind of talking about them. How to hiss? Well, obviously, what? Learning to point out what's going on, and learning to let someone know that whatever's going on doesn't feel right to you, doesn't feel good to you. Right? Is a kind of hiss. Right? So I think you know, there are various levels of hissing. You know, I think the simplest hiss is to, you know, just be aware of what you're feeling. Let somebody know that you're not comfortable or this is going too far or this is inappropriate or, you know, just a kind of, it doesn't have to be, you know, heavy duty, right? But it's a little bit of a hiss. Some people, you know, when there's a little hiss, get the message, right? And stop. Some people don't. So you got to hiss a little stronger. You got to repeat it a little more emphatically. But this is all kind of stuff you know in communication, conflict resolution, you know. But at a certain stage, you may have to set a boundary with a consequence, right? If you continue to do this, then, bah, you know, I'm leaving, or I'm, you know, or I'm going to end this conversation, or, you know, because this is not going anywhere, or I don't like the way you're talking to me, or, you know, right? So, you know, we don't have to get angry. See, a lot of times people, you know, they don't begin to kind of act in keeping themselves safe until they what? Are angry, right? Then when they're angry, because angry is a powerful energy. So now I feel strong. Yeah, but then often when we talk and act out in anger, you know, we do harm too. So obviously, the more we are self-aware, the more we're in control of ourselves, and the more that our actions are intelligent for the situation and the person. So again, it's a But again, you know, we have to be careful. I mean, when we're just learning anything, we learn by rote. If we don't know, we know, oh, we learn, oh, this is how you do it, and I'm just going to do it this way, right? But over time, we realize that life is much more amorphous, and so we want, you know, we want to be, again, I think a much better, again, I'm always into kind of hierarchy, which means, you know, less intense first, you know, little hiss. Little hiss doesn't work. Little louder hiss. Little hiss doesn't work. Maybe a little louder hiss. And then at a certain point, you know, you may have to exit. I guess worst case scenario, you may have to bite. But hopefully we don't get there. Oftentimes people get into those kinds of situations where people are just hurting each other because we've participated in the escalation of a situation. Right? We didn't set a boundary early on. And again, if you start setting these kind of boundaries early on, it's much easier, it's much less confrontational, and it usually works with a lot of people. Some people it doesn't, right? They have other agendas, or they just, they're kind of dense. Dense, I don't mean in a pejorative way, but dense mean they just don't get it. A lot of people are totally self-absorbed. Have you ever run into anybody like that? You know, they're just self-absorbed. You know, they think everyone in the world is here to meet their needs, right? You know, they're like babies. You know, like a baby. If the baby doesn't get its food on time, it what? It cries, right? They get a little older, and you take them to the store, and if you don't get them that little toy they want, what do? They throw a temper tantrum. There are a lot of people, they're adults, and they still do the same thing, right? You know, they don't get their way, and their response, they get so frustrated because they're like children, they're like babies. They think the world is their what? To meet all their needs. You know, that all their needs, all their wants should be satisfied immediately. You know, it only gets problematic when they think that's your job, you see? Or when you think you know, turning it around, you think that's their job, right? They're here to meet my needs. They're here to make me happy. See, there's no boundaries in that. There's no clarity, there's no self-awareness. You're here to learn how to be happy. Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, that's what practice is about, learning to dwell happily in the present moment. You know, if it was an impossible task, or if it's a task you couldn't get, you know, through manipulating somebody else or getting high or, you know, acting out in some pleasurable way, you know, if that was the only recourse, then that would be it. But, you know, through mindfulness meditation and these teachings, we learn, you know, I can be happy. I can be at peace within myself. I don't need externals for that. See, that's real empowerment. You know, when you know that, your need for others is not unhealthy anymore. Right? You know, I mean, Bill, you had a question the other day when you said, when I said I was doing a talk on boundaries, you said, oh, good, I could use some help there. What specifically were you asking?
Everything is already said.
Really? Oh, okay. Okay, so Bill says it's already been covered. Good. So let's keep it going. Any other questions? Online, yes, in the back. Just switch, wait. No, we don't take comments. We just take questions. Okay, do you have a question? Okay, thank you. Because I want to deal with questions. Yes? Well, again, our boundaries. Are you saying that into a microphone? So people can't hear you. Okay, so I should repeat the question. Yeah, so the question is, when you're working with people toward a common goal, and there turns out to be a disagreement about how we go about that, how do you resolve those boundary issues? Yeah, so, you know, that's life. Right? That's life. How do you resolve these issues? On the one hand, there's what? There's the world of me, of I, my views, my ideas, I, me, my, right? And that's where, you know, many people are coming from. Right? Then there is that place where we enter the world with other people. How do you navigate that? See, on the one hand, here's the needs of one, and here's the needs of many. I mean, if you look what's happening with the whole COVID vaccine thing and the mask thing, I mean, this is a boundary issue, right? Clear your boundary, that's all it is. Some people say what? My body, I can do whatever I want with it. Nobody can tell me to wear a mask. Nobody can tell me that I need to get vaccinated, it's, right? See, the boundary is right where? Right here. But what happens when that person with that very individualized boundary just around themselves enters the world of others, the well-being of others, which is the same thing she's talking about. We have a common goal. What is it, you know, to live in a civilized society is like to live in a civilized home, is like to live, to be in civilized relationships, which means what? There's an acknowledgement of the other, right? There's an acknowledgement of the needs of others. There's an acknowledgement that my actions affect others. You see? I mean, if you're only thinking about yourself and what benefits you, then that's a very rigid boundary, isn't it? But when your boundary is more porous because you understand we interact, so you begin to make a boundary around a group of people. Right? We make a boundary around our society. You know, I don't want anybody to do me harm. So therefore, I don't want to do harm to others. Right? I mean, just think what it could, I mean, it's the basis of civilized society, so-called. I mean, one can debate whether we live in a civilized society, civilized world, but at its best, the whole idea of a civilized society is people came together and made a compact. Agreed on general rules, laws, procedures, common values, right? And that we would all kind of subscribe to that, right? Like we all, you know, we all observe the same speed limit. It's not a personal choice, is it? Right? We all drive on the side of the road we're told to drive on. I mean, could you imagine what the world would be as, hey, no one tells me, I'm an individual. I have a right to drive as fast as I want, anywhere I want. So can you see the balance? So again, boundary is a very interesting issue in our society. It's not just personal anymore. It's not just interpersonal, it's also societal. I mean, look at climate change. I mean, they're just having, or I don't know if it's over with, that international conference, right? And so what do you have there? 200 individual countries, clearly defined borders, right? What do? Are you there just to represent me and my country and what's best for my country? Or do you acknowledge that these boundaries need to be porous, that climate change is something that doesn't respect physical boundaries, right? You know, can individual countries put aside their narrowness, their complete identification with what's best for me, what's best for my economy, what's best for me right now? See, that's what we're talking about. That's no different than what I was just talking about in individual relations. What's best for me? And oftentimes it's what's best for me right now. Right now. My needs, my wants, you know, it's not the whole, not the other person, or not the future. Right? You know, what if my boundary is, it's just about me right now, getting as much as I can right now. As much happiness, as much this, as much that. Without any, you know, awareness of future. You know, young people, children, you know, worlds, you know. You see? So boundaries can be very rigid and unhealthy. You know, if the 200 countries of this world cannot put aside their personal boundaries and their me-ism and begin to embrace, you know, a bigger sense of, you know, that there's a boundary around, the real boundaries around the whole world. You see? So, you know, it's like we talk about relationships, you know, from a family therapy point of view, the challenge for couples is what? How do two I's become a we? Right? That's the challenge. Many people don't successfully navigate that one. Two individuals with their own boundaries, whatever that means, and then they enter a relationship with another person. Can they lower the boundaries enough? Are they permeable, interactive enough that they can create something that benefits both of them? Or are they what? Are they going to spend their relationship at war with one another? You know, trying to control and manipulate the other person to meet their needs. Right? And whether that goes on in a relationship of two, or whether that goes on in a world, right? You know, endlessly making war with one another, right? Hurting one another, taking over one another, right? Anyhow, more questions. Don't be shy. I mean, if you're sitting there with a question about how to apply this to real situations in your life, please don't be shy. Yes, Teresa. Boundaries and attachments. Obviously, in Buddhism, we say one of the biggest causes of our suffering is we are attached to things, right? And we can be attached to our boundaries. You know, one of the biggest attachments we have is, you know, is this concept of, you know, my, you know, very much our society is very individualistic. Anybody ever notice that? Right? I mean, it was quite interesting when I was younger and I traveled around the world. You know, I remember I was in the Middle East and I was staying with some people, and you know, they had two rooms in their house, right? At night, they just took out all these kind of bedroll, and everybody, parents, children, grandparents, everybody just kind of slept in the same room. I remember when I lived with Tibetans, this whole big family with the grandparents all lived in one big bed. It filled up the whole room. Just a thing for. They all slept there. No, I grew up in a culture where what? Every child needs what? Anybody know what every child needs? Their own room, right? I mean, I grew up in a very deprived environment. I had to share my room with my brother, but. Interesting, isn't it? Boundaries, right? So we don't even know it, but this sense of privacy and my space, my time, my needs, my wants, you know, we are very attached to. And it's often hard for us to realize, Buddhism teaches, that attachment is a source of suffering because it's actually isolating. It's creating aloneness, loneliness. We are very, you know, conscious of protecting our boundaries around me. And many people do that very well. And then what do they do with their alone time? You see, what do they do with their alone time? Do they do things that are really very meaningful and nurturing? Now I got my time and my space. And then what do I do? And, you know, there's a lot of interactive time. There's a lot of being with other people and being there with others, which is actually a lot more nourishing. But again, we are, we're attached. Yeah, so, yeah, so in Buddhism, no matter what it is, right, we have to be careful about attachment. You know, attachment to our views, you know, we can be rigid, you know. And that just causes suffering. Because then our views and our ideas get in the way of our ability to, you know, navigate life in a flexible way. Any other questions about boundaries, Buddhism, the balance between the conditional and the non-conditional, the unconditional? I'm going to hope this, you're getting a sense that one can, there's a meeting ground where they interpenetrate. In Buddhism, at the deepest level, we talk about form is emptiness, emptiness is form. The absolute and the relative are the same. One can live a totally free life and enter relationships and have good sense of boundaries, but it doesn't have to be a wall. It doesn't have to be a barrier. It doesn't have to be the defining moment. It's just something very flexible that we use when needed. Because we're aware of ourselves, and we know when something within us is being violated. How do we know that? Because we feel it. We're in touch with ourselves. We feel uncomfortable. We know there's something going on here that's not right. We stop. We are mindful. We are attentive. And we're present to it. And then we step back from the situation in objectivity and see, well, what's going on here? We stop and ask ourselves these reflective questions. What's going on here? Why am I feeling this way? Something's off. You know, it may not be obvious to us right away, but something's off. And so we stop and we reflect, and that's how we grow. So it's very important, you know, again, that's why fear and anger are so dangerous, because oftentimes when we are driven by emotionality, we act out from emotionality, rather than from clarity and understanding. So when we take the time to be self-reflective, to be mindful of, right, what's going on inside me, what's the situation, what's causing it, you know, and, you know, what would be a good remedy? Again, that's if you have time. And then you act, but then you're acting from an ability to discern, you know, with some clarity and balance, what the situation is and what could be, you know, what is really needed. You know, what would be a skillful response, a helpful response. And again, setting boundaries is often a very compassionate action, because a lot of times people are out of control, right? And so sometimes you setting a boundary on them is helpful to them because they don't see the boundary. So when you go, stop, right? Stop. Do you notice there's a boundary here? And you're beginning to cross it, right? That's that early hiss. Learning to see that early on and to be not afraid to say something is very helpful, right? It saves a lot of suffering. And it says a lot of significant. I mean, again, a lot of people, they just don't deal with things early on. again, either just because they're not as self-aware, or because, again, lots of fear, or they use anger to empowerment. It's only when they get, you know, really angry do they ever then do act out, right? But that's not our way, you see. Self-awareness is our way. Mindfulness is our way. Reflection is our way. Acting skillfully is our way. And how does one learn to act skillfully? Over time, we need to practice. How do we learn? We make mistakes. don't be, if this is all new for you or difficult for you, don't be turned off by the fact you may not get it right away. You know, we're in process. We watch, we learn. We see what happens when we act in a certain way. If it gives the desired outcome, good. If it doesn't give the desired outcome or blows up in our face, that's good too. All right. You know, you can always say to the other person, hold on, let me try that one again. That didn't seem to work. Anything else? Any questions online or in the house? Yes, Teresa, and we'll end in just a few minutes.
Sometimes it seems that the issue of boundaries and attachment arose from teaching for mothers. Not many great teachers were mothers. Does everything you said also apply to mothers?
Yeah, so it's funny because, Although the question is, All that teaching about boundaries and attachment. I've looked at all those teachers. They seem to be predominantly men. How about mothers and their attachment for their child? I guess the implication is, yeah. Yeah, boundaries. So we know that between a parent and a child, and as a father, I'll try to include fathers in that. In the early stages, there's not a lot of boundaries, is it? The child is included, totally included in our boundaries. Actually, it's almost the child is elevated, right? We probably take more care and more sacrifice for the child than we probably do for ourselves, right? But again, flexibility and fluidity and intelligence, right? If you're still, taking care of your kid when he's 25 or when he's 15, if you're still making all the decisions, if you're still the protector of, if you're still trying to control their behavior, right? What was appropriate when they're little can be not very helpful, could actually be harmful, right? So that's that enmeshment, right? Enmeshment between a parent and a child at a young age is necessary. Right? I mean, it's a natural, for most people, a natural thing, where you feel this connection, this lack of boundaries between you and your child. So therefore, you're always taking care of them, right? But that's got to change. Because if it doesn't, it will damage the child. And it'll also cause the parent lots of suffering. Right? Because they see the child as part of themselves. They don't see the clear boundaries that this is an independent person. Right? They're not an object of my creation. And again, when they're little, they are our creation. And so we totally take care of them. But over time, as they begin to express their own individuality, we realize, oh, this is a person. Right? This is a real person, just like me. And so again, as I said, boundaries is a flexible, open thing. So why don't we stop? Thank you. Hopefully I gave you something to chew on today. I know after, there'll be a time after the talk today for people to get into small groups and share about the topic today and your own experience with boundaries. So please take advantage of that. Thank you.